I'm on the freeway. It's moving slowly. There's a pink and purple sunset straight ahead. I'm in a hurry. Sunset's not moving. Only now the light is changing it to red. And I'm glad to be reminded of something I value more than just going where I'm headed here and now. I'm on the freeway. I'm in a hurry. And there's beauty laid before me anyhow. There is beauty right before me here and now. And I'm reminded of a morning. We were marching to oppose a coming war. We were angry, and on both sides of us, the police were in a phalanx in a fearful show of force. And as we walked together in our anger, pain, and fear, you looked up and said, "The sky is so clear, so blue." We were marching. We were angry. And you pointed out the beauty of the view. You made sure that we kept beauty in our view.
I mean, it's really just descriptive statistics. It's not like mm-hmm. high-level stuff.
What is this new article? What's the sort of themes to it?
I'm trying to remember. It was about...
This is what happens, like, we do this study and then it takes like months and years to get anything published.
Yeah.
So,
well, this one's got a much quicker turnaround. Mm-hmm. Magazine will just, right.
Wasn't it the dark side of community? That's what I mean. Or yes. The
disagreement and conflict.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we had a lot of data on disagreement and conflict.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Right. Magazine article number 2. Conflict resolution and satisfaction. So he reused the satisfaction scale and compared it against conflict resolution types. So whether or not a community nice. Uses a particular type. So here you can actually see the boxes
data.
That I created.
Love data. So the satisfaction score was highest with co-counseling. Interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, so what happens to someone if there's a conflict? Does your community do any of these things? Mm-hmm. How does that affect overall satisfaction?
What's interesting about this is that shunning or isolation creates the lowest amount, which is interesting because it's kind of anti-community practice in some ways, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're...
Although it works for the Amish.
Yeah.
Apparently.
But they don't live communally. And I mm-hmm. what I wrote in there was like, if your community is practicing shunning or isolation, it's just as likely to create dissatisfaction as it is to be the result of dissatisfaction. Like mm-hmm. we would mm-hmm. need to measure that and plumb that question deeper to know which was the major cause of dissatisfaction, mm-hmm. which way that went.
Right. And I like seeing required community conflict resolution processes as the number one thing. And then it was like non-specific, but...
Yeah.
Having that requirement. Yeah, I talked that up at the co-housing conference, our top 3 satisfaction factors that came out of the big study that we did.
Yeah.
With the required conflict resolution, egalitarian decision making, and income sharing, which was like the unexpected find in that study for me. All right.
I don't know if you need this as a reference or not. It all actually sounds like you all are on the same page about a lot of stuff.
I think we worked it out. We had a moment yesterday in Lowe's that was a little like, couldn't figure out the language to use to communicate with each other about what we were doing, but I think we got there.
Yeah, it took
with
a lot.
With very little help from the mansplaining dude who helped us, so.
Yeah, who we both went up and asked the question, they turned to me and just talked the whole time.
I was like, dude.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
It sucks.
But not
unexpected.
Unusual, yeah.
Right, right.
Not
yeah.
unexpected. And I feel like we sometimes run into the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's one of the things I actually like about Lodern, our local place, is that like I have never gotten any mansplaining attitude from the folks that work there.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're talking about building the chicken coop for our 43 new chickens, which we're just really, really excited about. And we've been wanting to do this for a long time. As we're heading into the second year, the timing is really perfect for doing it. And the timing is also perfect because Zach is here to help us.
Yay!
And I feel, but I also feel kind of bad because I've been part of teams that have built chicken coops before. And I like doing it, and I enjoy it, and I kind of wanted to get out in front of it, but I'm also kind of swamped with work, with working for the man, and so you know it's just that's kind of kicking my ass a little bit, and so it's great to you know have other people also want to build the coop, so that you know that means a lot. So you know I'll be kind of helping more than you know I'll be on alongside, which is actually kind of a neat place to be too, in many ways.
I'm glad to help shepherd this project. So starting with Yana's design, you know, we're getting your help along and a lot of other people's help tomorrow when we finish it. But this is like the biggest chicken coop I will have ever built, and I've built three or four, and it's usually for just you know half a dozen chickens at most, and this is going to be for 43 chickens.
Yeah,
sure. Well, the original design, it's so this is like a double decker thing. There's the lower level, like if you basically picture a very large table that has chicken wire all around the legs of the table and the chickens hang out underneath the table, like that's basically what the lower level original design was, and we were just going to like get posts and chicken wire and plywood, and then in one of the corners of the plywood actually cut out a square hole that would be the entry into the top layer. And the original design was that we were just going to take this little storage shed that we have on the property and like sort of plunk it on top of that to make that upper level and sort of reuse an entire small structure. And then we figured out that when we actually cleared out the floor of it, when we were cleaning it out at our last work party, we figured out that, oh, there's actually a cement floor that's sort of locking it into place. And so suddenly it felt like it was going to be a lot more complicated to move it. So we've been going back and forth about what to do with that sort of second upper level. But right now, because we're still in summer for a while, we're just going to go ahead and build that lower level deck tomorrow. And as we were trying to figure out what materials we had on the property that we could reuse, one of the things that was left was, so the former owner of the property was a real estate agent and had these like pretty badass, like, you know, 4x4 or 3x3?
They're 4x4.
They're 4x4. Yeah. Yeah, so they're like 4x4, 8 foot tall posts with an arm coming out that he would hang his real estate sign off of. And so we're basically gonna take those and put them together, so there'll be like two of those facing in. So the arms will like face into each other, and then we'll attach the arms to each other underneath the wood, the plywood. And I think it's going to be super sturdy and badass and actually pretty interesting looking, because there's also this sort of decorative knob that sticks up at the top of each one of those that'll be visible kind of all around the perimeter. So it really, you know, we called it the Chicken Palace, and it's sort of going to have like palace-like decorations kind of off of it. So I think it's going to be great, and Zach has been like incredibly helpful. He was the one who came up with the idea of reusing those. And it's also now going to be 8 feet tall, so we can put so many perches underneath, and it's going to be like, you know, like the McDonald's children's playhouse for chickens.
Yeah,
it's going to be awesome under there.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And so when we talk about the aesthetic of reusing, in our last episode, in our last Solidarity House episode, we had a conversation with Jason, one of our members, really. He doesn't live on the land, but he is a kind of a 24/7 member and an artist who does a lot of artwork here and uses the Quonset Hut as both a studio and a storage place for art, and all of his art is recycling, basically. It's, you know, taking other people's junk and turning it into something that also contains the seeds of some kind of social commentary, often about, you know, what about kind of the what that thing is and sort of the process that it has gone through. And so I don't think there's a better symbol of that than us expropriating these real estate signs.
Totally.
Because this project, by, you know, by which I mean, you know, the entire Solidarity Collective project, is a kind of repudiation of traditional models of land markets and real estate markets, and says, well, there's a better way, you know, for people to live together. And so we're taking the previous owner's real estate signs and using them in something.
And letting our chicken shit all over them.
Well, I totally didn't even grasp that metaphor, but that's wonderful.
That's, yeah, I mean, that's an example, though, of something that sort of serendipitously comes up as we go through the process. But then you see that it has, it's possible to attach that kind of meaning to it.
To have all of that excess stuff that he hoarded and just dumped here, and then have that available to repurpose and reuse. It's you're definitely just like flipping the system on its head.
Yeah, now I want to be like, ladies and gentlemen, those who are both and neither, Dr. Zach Rubin, sociologist.
Oh God, yeah, that's me. I'm a doctor of got a social problem. That's what I'm the doctor of. That's what I can cure for
you. A social disease?
Yeah.
You're a doctor? You can cure my social disease?
Yeah. No, just the group's disease. Not, I can diagnose it very well.
I'll break into a rousing rendition of Officer Krumke.
Dear Officer Krumke, what am I to do?
That's because in high school, in our production of West Side Story, I was Officer Krumke.
Oh, man.
I know. It's there's the very people that would appreciate hearing that also give me shit about
it. You two are cute.
Yeah, it's the only time that I've ever been a cop.
So. Dodge that one. Yeah.
But,
yeah. I think that because we're building this at such a major scale, and using these big, heavy real estate posts, the challenge is, one, going to be getting enough hands there to hold these things up until we can brace them and cross-brace them, because you don't want to, like, put it up and then it's not attached to something, so it falls over and drags the rest of the apparatus with it and cracks a piece of wood. I think the other big challenge will probably be, once we construct it, to move it where it needs to be, because where it needs to be is in the middle of some tall grass, which is not ideal for assembly. So we're assembling it elsewhere and moving it there. So hopefully no one hurts themselves.
Oh, I didn't realize that was happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be, we're going to need probably more than the four of us tomorrow to get the frame moved. So.
Okay. Well, that's,
I wonder if, well, we should look at it and see if it is possible to assemble it in place. We can sort of, you know, snug the bottom things down in the grass. And, like, because as soon as you get one set of those posts on there, they're going to be, it's going to be pretty heavy.
Yeah.
You know, and
you're just describing the same problem with from a different angle. It's like, if we do it in one place, we have this challenge. If we do it in another place, we have the other challenge.
Right. And
two sides of the same coin.
What do we have the human capacity to do? And I'm wondering if we're going to have enough people to be able to move it all put together. So we'll get into it tomorrow. And we'll come back and record somewhere once we figure out what approach we've taken. Yeah.
Well, I know you all are going to have a fun time trying to move the chickens. That sounds like a challenge that I'm now.
We'll just herd them. Let You're, six out at a time or three at a time and herd them in there.
It might be a problem if we were not, if one of us were not a chicken whisperer.
Yeah, oh, it's okay. True. It's but true. Matt is the chicken whisperer.
I am a credentialed chicken whisperer. I have.
Do you want to introduce?
No, I think you should.
Okay.
You're the lead okay. dog on this project.
Yeah. Well, I think it required all three members to make this project happen, but Yana and I have a forthcoming article in the journal Sociological Spectrum, where we did a survey of, using the Fellowship for Intentional Communities database, all their member communities. We got about 300 good responses, just shy of that. And
which was an amazing response rate.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah,
and when we had amazing. We had an article or a journal turn us down for a low response rate, I was like, are you kidding me? This is better than, like, you know, people are polling for the next presidential election. They got like a 5% return rate, and we got, you know, 15% return rate, which is great. But anyway, so there was just a huge host of questions on this survey that we did, and what we ended up with, the most useful things that we found ended up being around defining success in intentional communities. There is an existing body of literature that talks about success, and when they do, it has to do with how long a community has lasted. And so the most classic piece is by Rosabeth Moss Cantor. She wrote and published a book in 1972 where she found that communities up to that point in U.S. history, the ones that lasted the longest were the ones that had the strongest commitment mechanisms. So this had to do with, say, having a religion that everybody in the community shared, or some sort of daily ritual that the community all partook in. And so there's variations of this in the literature. One person, I think it's Irons, talks about costly to fake commitments, that, you know, giving up tobacco, you could fake that. You know, you could sneak off into a corner and smoke that when they're not looking, or giving up worldly possessions. Like, you could say you did that, but then have someone else hold on to your possessions when you get into this community. And our paper is premised on, what if the definition of success is not how long a community lasted, but how they feel in the pursuit of their mission? Do they feel like they're pursuing their mission and accomplishing that? And so out of it, we asked a series of questions.
Let me toss something in while you're looking that up.
Sure.
Which is, it's an interesting thing, because if you think about, like, one-on-one relationships, like, a lot of really bad relationships last for a really long time for really bad reasons. And, you know, and so it's an interesting thing that, like, for a long time, that was sort of the community's movement standard of what successful was, where, you know, I'm highly skeptical of that, having lived in a number of different communities and looking at, like, how influential a lot of those communities are on people's lives who don't even stay in the community. You know, they come through, they're there for 3 weeks or 6 months or a year, so not a very long period of time in the course of their lives, and they then go out and do really interesting things in the world that were influenced by their time there. And to me, that success, and it has nothing to do with how long the community lasts or even how long people stay, or, you know, like, how fast your turnover is and that kind of stuff. And so those were questions that I was really interested in going into this.
And I totally share your skepticism very deeply, because so many of those communities that did last a long time did so because one of the classic cases would be a group of German immigrants, the Amana colonies, who were arguably quite influential. But one of the main reasons that they were so successful in terms of longevity was because generations of members didn't learn English. Mm-hmm. And so they had a huge barrier to leaving, even if they wanted to. So there's this sort of, like, ethnic and linguistic and religious homogeneity that contributed to their longevity, but it doesn't necessarily translate to a mission that people held a deep belief in and investment in its success.
Right. Or even, like, really meeting people's genuine social needs or economic needs while you're in the community, which to me is much more interesting than how long any particular project lasts. It's like, are people really getting their actual needs met?
Right, right. So to go back to what I was talking about with satisfaction in the community, some of the questions that we asked, and we built a scale that goes from a 0 to 130 because it's a 13-question scale, but we asked questions like, you know, rank on a 1 to 10, 1 being strongly agree, 10 being strongly disagree. My community's decision-making process is functional. My community's decision-making voice, decision-making process excludes some voices. My decision-making process is easy to understand. My decision-making process, or my community's decision-making process, has been a source of a lot of struggle. So, you know, we inverted some of the numbers on that to so that, you know, when people feel like they're have a voice in their decision-making system, and their decision-making system is more functional, we rated that highly, that somehow this community is generating a degree of investment and belief and a sense of working towards its mission in a good and smoother way. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, yeah. It makes sense. What am I talking about?
Yeah. Well, it's what we got out of it.
Yeah.
And so what was really interesting for me, like in some of this, so the role that I played in the study was I was mostly on the front end of like helping design it and thinking about the questions, because I've been doing, training and consulting work with communities like this. And I've lived in community for most of my adult life. And so I was the sort of like on the ground person to go like, no, that's not really the right question. And like, actually, this would be a really interesting angle to look at and that kind of stuff. And so and I went into it, you know, sort of speculating like, well, maybe we're going to find this. And that would sort of, you know, add to what I think I already know about communities. And so some of the results that we got reinforced things that I already thought, and some of them really didn't. And that was great. Like, I feel like I learned a lot actually by being intimately in the study. But the three things that came back as like the strongest factors in satisfaction, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Zach as
the
I'm saying it, make sure
scale.
I say it's the satisfaction scale, were mandatory conflict resolution, having some kind of egalitarian decision-making process. And those two didn't surprise me. What did surprise me, though, was that income sharing was the third one on that list. And that's a form of community that, you know, even within the communities movement is kind of a fringe thing. You know, something like 13% of current communities do income sharing. And so I was like, really? That's really a high satisfaction. And I think that the possibility of doing income sharing is really scary to people. You know, it feels like so high stakes. And yet it also, like, one of the things that the study came up with is like, yes, it probably feels really high stakes and scary, and it's probably worth it.
Yeah. One of the things to reflect further on that is you're right. It's on the fringe. And we asked the question, does your community do income sharing? And they had three options. No, partial income sharing or full income sharing. And we had so few responses to the second two that we had to collapse partial and full into its own variable to compare no income sharing versus any income sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And it made a difference in our satisfaction scale. The one thing that surprised me the most was, yes, egalitarian decision making was important, but what was more significant was not whether the consensus or egalitarian procedures were actually working, but that was what the community was based on. That I think a lot of people saw their consensus process as dysfunctional, but also that they were more satisfied by the idea that there were avenues and mechanisms and they could have buy-in if it was more functional. So they were happy to have a consensus decision-making body, like in theory, in enshrined in their documents or their organization. And there was, you know, because consensus isn't always functional, that they were slightly less satisfied with it in practice as it was working, which
it's
is also
interesting.
And
I wonder, and this is speculative, you know, we don't have the data on this, but the thing that I wonder as, you know, somebody who's a professional in the field is like, is that because when you set out as a community to do consensus, you're also sort of leaning into cooperation and an attempt to work things out, because that's really built into consensus, mm-hmm. that you're intending to be doing something that is more cooperative, and that maybe that intention drives other things in your thinking that we weren't like measuring necessarily in the study. And so that's the kind of stuff that I wonder is, like there's definitely part of me that's like, we should be doing like follow-up studies, except yeah, we still yeah. haven't like even crunched all the data from this
oh,
one.
Oh, I know. We did collect follow-up emails and we haven't done that because there's just that. so much data.
Right.
But I was particularly thankful to have you on the project for just that sort of thing about like what questions should we be asking. Because if I was to look at, you know, people who have run these sort of tests before and looked at this sort of question before, it's mainly historical, and the communities movement today is very different from that of what, you know, the communes that arose in the 60s and 70s, the religious communes and the Owenites and the Fourierists of the 1840s and 50s, and mm-hmm. the socialist communes of the 1880s and 90s. Like, it just looks different today. And so, you know, it's good to re-examine and retest, you know, these theories that were developed before, but it's pointless to ask the exact same question because the movement looks so different than it used mm-hmm. to. And so I was yeah. really appreciated. I think you added a lot to the project for that. And I also want to shout out Professor Don Willis at the University of Arkansas Little Rock, who was our stats guy and really made the numbers make sense, because I know, you know, a moderate amount of stats, he's the expert, and he really told us what the data meant.
Yes, Don so. Kept us honest is how I think about it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. No, actually what the data says is this, not the thing that you kind of want it to say. So yeah. I think he did a good job of reining me in anyway with that, because there were, you know, I had hopes about what was going to come out, and he was really good about like, well, kind of.
Yeah. That's the thing with statistical studies is you can't ever say like anything too definitively. You can only say it with, you know, a little bit, a medium amount, or high degree of confidence. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm, you can't say this causes that.
Right.
Like we think these two are linked and there might be some relationship between the two with mm-hmm. such and such amount of confidence.
Right,
and,
right.
Which I know is really difficult for a lot of people to hear. They want definitive answers, but you know.
Totally. And particularly yeah. like somebody like me who likes, I work in the field. Like I really want to know that I'm doing the right things, and having good data mm-hmm. helps you know that you're doing the right things. But you know, it's all still a little murky in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that I want to sort of put a bug in your ear about in terms of future studies of stuff is, so last summer I ran some numbers using the, so it was the Fellowship for Intentional Community, and it's now called the Foundation for Intentional Community, but it's still IC.org where the community's directory lives. And I had gone onto the directory and looked at like, so what percentage of communities currently that are listed in the directory as established, versus what percentage of communities that are forming are doing income sharing or intending to do income sharing. And it was about that 13% mm-hmm. That, you know, that we've been bantying around. But when you looked at forming groups, it was 18% of forming groups. And so I'm going to be really curious to see if those, if like that same percentage of groups actually gets up and off the ground. And if it, you know, maybe it is that like more groups that intend to do income sharing because you're like shooting for the moon a little bit, maybe more of those don't make it and the numbers always look that way. Yeah. Or maybe there's actually a bump up and more interest in income sharing, which wouldn't shock me given like economic insecurity stuff that's happening like on a broader cultural level. But I'll be very curious to see if there is a bump up, and the directory is about to get somewhat restructured, so it's going to be hard to take data from 5 years ago and data from this year and data in 5 years.
No, it's going to get restructured.
It's going to get restructured. It's a
nightmare for anybody who wants to do data crunching.
I know. I'm bummed about it. It's going to be cleaner data, I think, but it's not going to be able to be apples to apples with our old numbers that we had run. So anyway, so I will be curious to see if income sharing is actually on the rise or if it's just like more interesting to people right now. So.
Or if it's has a higher failure rate.
But right.
Yeah. That, right. Again, I think you nailed it that we need a time series
yep.
to look at that.
Yeah. So, you know, just in your spare time, being a, you know, full-time professor and doing all this other stuff.
Many paper ideas.
Many paper writing ideas, right. Yeah. Right. Cool. All right, good.
Including I'm writing a piece right now on technology and intentional communities, because there's a lot of different opinions between the sort of technocentrists that accept a sort of premise that we can innovate our way to sustainability, and maybe more primitivists, maybe that's not the right word, but, you know, people who see a resurgence in more traditional low impact and you know, low technologies.
Like that's, hand tools versus power tools.
I call to mind, there's someone at Dancing Rabbit who thought everything should be run with bicycle pedals, like washing machine bicycle pedals, you know, power generation bicycle pedals, you know, mobility and transport bicycle pedals, and which is a very traditional technology, right? Like it's an old technology, but it's still very useful. So I'm still working on what exactly that paper is going to look like.
It's like tech versus tech, like spy versus spy.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So, all right. Okay. Well, thank you, Zach.
Well, I'm singing you the song, you can consider it a bribe. For our co-op Patreon, to convince you to subscribe, we can't continue operations without support from you. So to explain why that's important, here's a list of what we do. There's the story of the house and the town of Laramie, Wyoming tenant rights and the carbon industry, analyzing geopolitics and left candidates, LGBTQAA plus issues and poverty rates, fighting ICE detention centers and discussing greener deals, investigating police shootings and Roe v. Wade repeals. There's cooperative economics, ecofeminist, socialist, reformist, revolutionaries, anarcho-syndicalists, American and Canadian indigenous. There's our original music and the music of our guests. We cover climate change protests, we sing anti-fascist songs, international human rights, and capitalism's wrongs. Patreon.com/solidarityhouse. We're here talking to Betsy Morris and Rains Cohen, and we're talking specifically about the problem of folks staying in community, staying in their homes, being able to have affordable housing, also to keep long-term affordable housing for people. Your project or your proposal is the Squirrel Fund, and that's people-powered social impact crowdfunding. We can discuss whether it's really crowdfunding, by and for co-housers, and Squirrel is senior equity into revolving or
regenerative
real estate loans, and made possible in partnership with Co-Housing California, Aging in Community, and the Northern California Land Trust. There's been a huge resurgence of interest in community land trusts lately, along with interest in co-housing. And what would you attribute maybe that the wide interest that people are having in getting into these kind of housing arrangements?
Well, the community land trust is a particularly flexible way to drop the cost of housing, because the cost of the land is taken out of the equation. Community, I mean, you probably have had podcasts about community land trusts, but I think there's several things that have driven it. One is the millennials have experienced the absolute, you know, evidence of the wealth gap as it exists in real estate, which is to say the cost of housing almost everywhere is out of reach for someone entering their working years. So there's not a place in the country that has enough housing for people who make minimum wage, for example, that's affordable to that people at that level. So the idea of looking for alternatives financially is very important, but I also think that's married to the loneliness and the isolation and the fragmentation that devoting your life to working 60 hours a week has caused, or being unemployed and isolated at the end of a bus line.
Well, I was working with my neighbor, Alice, the founder of our community and a real inspiration in living simply and living well. participating in the sharing economy in so many ways. And she had planned all along to be able to get a reverse mortgage, a federally backed and insured program that would be the nearest thing available to a pension to people, thanks to an insurance program that comes with it, a guaranteed income for as long as she lived and lived in the home. And then after 2008, after the crisis, they rewrote the rules, and in the process, they're like, what's this co-housing thing? They put in a pile of stuff they didn't understand. If we foreclose, are we going to have to come cook the meals together? They're looking for a commodity product, and it took education work on our part to help the feds understand, oh, this is just a condo legally. Oh, no problem. Okay. We did a whole process lobbying HUD. And in the process, we're like, wait, why are we jumping through all these hoops so somebody else can make a bunch of money off of Alice? She doesn't need very much to live simply. You know, as an activist, her Social Security isn't enough for homeowners dues, taxes, and food. And with inflation, some of our costs were going up. And so we said, hey, can we band together? Can we make sure that she can get what she needs and we can do it in a way that's secure and comfortable? And as a community, it's not just about the money, even, it's about the relationships. And that's, to me, the real secret sauce of community.
So for me, the light turned on when Alice said, well, I don't even want to support the banks. Can I do this without the banks? Reverse mortgages are done through banks, and this particular federal program that enables her to get more than the value of her home, for example, until she dies, is federally insured. And so that's where all the complications started happening, because as a co-housing community, your land is co-owned. She had a number of challenges that someone living, for example, in a cooperative might also have, where they, in a cooperative situation, you can't foreclose, a bank cannot foreclose on the corporation, the nonprofit corporation, the limited equity that owns the whole property, and you just own a share. So the idea of creating an alternative to the banking system, which already exists in the form of cooperative housing trusts and loan funds all over the country.
We can cast a wider net and say, yeah, let's put our investment, our retirement, and other investments aligned with our values into community in a way that we know is safe. And with the backing of the land trust and their security, we know that we can help out, and we can do it in a way that gives us choices. And collectively, the more we federate, the more we cooperate, right, the more freedom we all get.
So we've, because of our advocacy and evangelism and involvement with both intentional communities, but especially with co-housing, and my own background as a affordable housing and sort of anti-poverty community development planner, you know, I know certain things, that like the fact that this affordable housing crisis is everywhere in this country. It's not like there's a place you can go unless you already have some money. If you don't have that home base, it's very hard to have that vision that, well, I'll have enough, I lived my life as a peace activist or as a recycler, as a voluntary simplicity person, and people are still ending up, they could easily end up on the streets.
No, it's very hard, what's happening. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Because you also...
Cheap housing just isn't cheap anymore.
You also are at a juncture where you no longer feel like you can just, well, if that doesn't work out, you know, I will try practicing law, or, you know, something. I mean, I will try this other thing that long ago I decided to turn the other way from, or I was about to do that, and I decided to be an activist. Now I'm, you know, approaching
your choice is hitting against a wall. Yeah,
and
we designed, you know, a brochure. We have a budget pro forma showing.
It's moving from a proposal to a project. We launched it at the National Co-Housing Conference last month.
Okay. But we also see it and are finding a lot of resonance with people who could see it applied to their cooperative, or they would like to put some money into this rather than a CD. So how it works is a convergence of both needs and interests. But in her case, so let's say a senior wanted to apply. We would talk to them to find out what their actual income is, the shape of the house. It has to be viable as a house now. But as part of the interview process, we create a kind of support team for that senior.
It's a lot about network mapping. Who are their allies? Who are their friends? Who do they talk to? Who cares about them? Who might be interested in investing? Who might be interested in supporting in other ways? Money is just a step, a tool in the process.
But it's about so much more. What we discovered with Alice is, for example, she didn't realize she was now eligible for food stamps. Mm-hmm. So we were able to increase her income, which is about $800 to $1,200 a month, depending on how much she works.
She's living well in the expensive Bay Area on an income like that.
But because of increases in our HOA dues, our HOA dues will double in 5 to 7 years. So knowing at that point she would be choosing between food and housing, as many seniors are, we worked out a thing. Well, could we raise $12,000 a year, which would still put her below her choice to live below the taxable income line? So that's her choice as a life choice. She's done that for herself, lived as a war tax resister and not paid taxes. And she would be exempt from taxes. And the loan is not income. A loan is tax exempt. Mm-hmm. It's not counted. So on a practical legal matter, we've worked out certain details. Sorry, I'm clicking.
That's right.
So your question, though, going back to how does it work out?
It's
not for everyone, but here's two examples. Here's somebody who has a house that she does not have. She has an heir, but her heir doesn't need this home. And therefore, I talked to her. It's like, Alice, would you be willing to leave your home to a land trust or have an arrangement for, there's a wonderful alternative permanent real estate cooperative that started in the East Bay that's directed to people of color mm-hmm. who have...
We interviewed them.
Okay. Yeah. So this, you know, the inspiration for this comes from the environment, mm-hmm. you know, it didn't just... But bringing it all together, someone who has an asset in their home, is a senior, has, you know, we think, you know, you can think of it as a 15 to 25 year mortgage or loan of some sort. And the idea is that if we can raise small amounts of money from their family and friends as loans, those family and friends get, it could also be a donation. Don't get me wrong. We'd love that. But that is there the sweet spot where a modest loan every year will enable them to stay in their home. So it's not like going to cover all your nursing bills. It's not going to cover mm-hmm. all of that. But here's what's different is unlike a bank or even a City of Berkeley or a city's housing loan program, we create a team of people who care about this senior. And that team is looking out for all the different ways and helping them manage things like getting on food stamps, getting on Medi-Cal, navigating some of the healthcare system. Not to do it for them, but to be an ally and
an informational network to help them in terms of almost consolidate
partly an emotional support system. Mm-hmm. So we're expecting to work with a friend of Alice's who's a lawyer. And, you know, that is a lucky point there. But sure. Raines is a certified senior advisor, so he's made a point to know a lot of aspects of getting older that people might want to think about. And then we're connecting them locally to programs and services and people who can help them, even if they don't have a lawyer who's a friend.
The big flip is... Alice is not here as a consumer, as a service recipient, as somebody to be case managed as the institutions and the government would approach it. She is here as a neighbor, an ally, a friend, a supporter. She is a positive contributor. She gives me so much inspiration from her life, from her bicycling everywhere connection. She is a net contributor. She's a net supporter. So it's not about, oh, this is a funnel. We're funneling money down here and drain on society. No, this is, we're enabling somebody to be more of who they've become over their life and to live that to the fullest throughout their life.
So one of the third collateral, you know, the third mm-hmm. mission here, the first was to be a trusted ally to senior homeowners who need additional income to stay in their homes. to grow the stock of permanently affordable shared equity home ownership. Mm-hmm. We're doing this, we might do it regardless for Alice, but we're pursuing this because we think it's important to get more homes out of the speculative market. It lets people leave a legacy, you know, without, because many people want to leave a legacy for affordable housing to the next generation, and are not always able to do that and still stay in their own community. And three is to build a social impact finance network. So the social and the financial and the housing are all married, mm-hmm. is the goal here. And we see the network has to be local. It should be local and regional of people who know what the resources are and can support each other. And this is a model that actually the seniors in our community, our founders, got together several times in their existence and had their own, like, what do we need to do as we're getting older? Well, we need to have a will. We need to do power of attorney. These very, frankly, to me, dull and a little bit uninspiring, mm-hmm. but practical things that, so that you prepare for your death. And conscious dying is part of this. Consciously preparing is an important part of this.
So what I'm hearing from this reminds me very much of conversations that I've had with a movement in Laramie called the Death Collective, is end of life and funeral and other types of planning.
Beautiful.
To do funerals in people's homes and to, you know, again, to sort of sever people from this neoliberal paradigm that says every part of your life is subject to marketization.
Yeah.
And what you're offering here is really a very comprehensive severance from that in many ways. I mean, you're not going to be able to get completely off the grid, as it were, in this instance, but what you're able to do is both the house and the life become things that can be planned and part of a larger community and not just a profit-making entity.
Yeah, and that you're building relationships that will do their best. They can't guarantee if someone has Alzheimer's and is burning the house down, mm-hmm. I honestly don't know what will happen, but we're at least... there will be people from their family or a designated ahead of time to make certain decisions. Mm-hmm. And we want to have, part of the Squirrel Fund is having different institutional partners as well as this collective of people who are volunteering to be part of Alice's support team. And what's nice about this is you don't have to lend $12,000. You can lend $3,000 or $4,000. And the same, then we have this other asset, you know, this philanthropy of a sorts. And then we have another several individuals, maybe 10, who expressed interest. And that came from the co-housing conference. And both Alice and Rains presented the Squirrel Fund at the National Co-Housing Conference.
So we're getting it up and going. The website agingincommunity.com is where we're starting to put basic information about it.
Aging in community.
It's well beyond aging in place. When you're building a network of neighbors that care for one another, then it's a mutual reciprocal relationship and where you can do things like this, make this possible.
And I just got to say, your solidarity theme is really important because this also comes out of a desire to see the co-ops, co-housing, organic farm. Those of us who are creating things outside of the profit-driven universe, not to say we don't need to generate surplus, but that we can use our reserve funds, our savings, our surpluses, to create more of the kinds of things, institutions, communities, housing that we want in the world.
Excellent.
And definitely inspired by that larger issue.
Thanks a lot. Thank you for-
We built a thing.
It is a massive thing.
It is.
It's like practically a tiny house.
It is a tiny chicken house.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty big.
Or a chicken palace, depending on how you view it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the frame right now, so they need like a like an actual like laying and nesting area. But we managed to put together the bones of something pretty massive.
Yeah, and it took four or five of us at any given time. I mean, not everyone was doing stuff at the same time, but it was that many hands and bodies to make the work relatively light and not entirely unpleasant.
Yeah, yeah. It was good. It was fun.
We were out there for like almost 4 hours.
Yeah. And
like the only reason we stopped was because of the impending rain. I would have liked to add a door to it, but I guess that's for, you know, the future work party.
We
that's,
can do it.
Yeah, that's what we will do because Zach is hitting the road tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually on a several city tour. We need like a tour t-shirt or something.
Yeah.
From you. Where are you headed?
I'm headed to Moab and then Phoenix and then Albuquerque and then Little Rock and just a lot of other stuff.
Albuquerque and Little Rock, exactly, right next
yeah,
door to each
other. Yeah, I know. Put a lot of miles on my car this summer, but I'm really happy that I got to stop by the Solidarity House. That I've been fortunate enough to come here 2 years in a row, get to know people, get to know since you've bought the house. I'm just very excited about the project that you are embarking on here.
So what's some advice that you would leave with us for finishing the coop? What are some things that we should look for, keep in mind? And, you know, there's got to be something like, whatever you do, don't forget to,
paint the roof. Uh-huh. Probably add more screws to the roof too, but definitely paint it. It's untreated plywood, so that will be the first thing to go and to rot if you don't paint it. And the other things, I don't know, just treat your chickens with love and care. But you already know that. You're already going to do that, so.
What color should we paint it, Zach?
I don't know. You got any of the paint left over from painting the house?
Oh,
it'd be nice if it matched.
That would be kind of fun, actually.
Yeah. I mean, we could pretty easily do that. Yeah. We've got the whatchamacallits, right?
Yeah, the swatches. Paint chips. Yeah.
Although I think that there's a tiny little variation or a slight variation between the swatch and the maroon color on the house. Although I really like the, it's almost a wine.
Yeah, it's a little purpley. It's a little purpley.
Purpley. Things that's cool about having it be that tall is that we can put a full-size door in it. So we'll be doing that. And we just happen to have a bunch of doors, but there's this particular yellow one that we've had our eye on.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's so yellow.
I do like that we built a coop that was tall enough that you don't have to, like, stoop down to enter, Matt.
It's a hill giant sized chicken coop.
It's true. Yeah. No, it's big. And I like that too, because I think that sometimes people really emphasize the horizontal space or the horizontal size of something and don't take advantage of the lateral size, which is something you can do with chickens because they are very,
they're birds.
They're perchy creatures.
I'll be interested to see.
They like being on different levels. They like hopping from level to level. They will settle on particular places. They obviously like high places, but they're also okay kind of coexisting on different levels of height. So.
I'll be interested to see if they actually like hop from perch to perch and make their way all the way to the top, like just below the roof. So I've never seen a coop with, you know, that went that high. So,
and
I've never seen a chicken go that high.
I'm coming from, one experience of building a coop right next to some really, really tall trees. And they absolutely climb, and perch and sometimes spend the night, 40 or more feet in the air in those branches. And my dream is still to someday build a coop treehouse But in order to do that, we need to live in a place that has fucking trees.
So. Oops.
I see a few out the window, but that's the next property over.
Exactly, yeah. Next property over. You know, there's a reason why we got this one. But we'll plant some trees, and maybe we will have some chicken coops in those trees in the future. But in the meantime, we've got this tall Mead Hall-style coop that has this wonderful skeleton frame out that we will put a picture of on our on this particular podcast cover. So thank you, Zach.
Yeah, glad
thanks for coming, and thanks for being a Renaissance commie.
Yeah.
I think you mean Zach of all trades.
Oh.
When all the thinkers say it makes no sense, joy will dance, joy will dance. When the fighters say put up your best defense, joy will dance, joy will dance. And when the counters say I can't risk the expense, when the landlords say just build a bigger fence, when the cautious hearts say things are just too tense, joy will dance, 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 joy will sing. Joy will flash like a scarlet wing, like a sudden grin, like a happy child. Joy will dance and joy will leap and joy will smile. When all the talkers say there's just no chance, joy will dance. Thank you for sharing. Joy will dance. When the socialites say you can't join this dance, joy will, somewhere, joy will dance. And when the TV's got the whole world in its trance, when the sellers bring out the emperor's new pants, and the buyers are all lined up in advance, still, joy will dance, joy will dance, joy will dance, joy will dance, joy will dance. Joy will sing, joy will flash, like a silver wing, like a sudden grin, no, like a spring-fed stream on a summer day. Joy will dance and joy will leap and joy will play. Play, okay. And darkness just expands. Joy will, when the hopeless march in step to its somber bands. Joy will, and when time brings endings to the best laid plans, and to the homes of straw we build on shifting sands. While the ones left out still echo their demands, with the shackles of this cold world on their hands, still in some secret place that no one understands. Joy will dance, 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 joy will fly, joy will glint like the corner of your eye, in the dragon's jaws, in the winds of chance, in the face of everything. Joy will dance like a heart that leaps to the beat of a fresh romance. In the face of everything, joy will dance. In the face of everything, joy will dance. At the heart of everything, joy will dance.